Lovely to me seems too great to be true. You brought me sunshine, sweet wine, so fine, baby, you're fine.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Functional Nerds. My name's Patrick Hester. Say hi, John.
Hey, I'm John. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. We're going to do a real quick...
There's a reason we're doing a real quick one here.
Yeah, we're doing a real quick intro because our interview is rather long. We've been trying to keep the podcast shorter than it usually is, or it has been in the past, and we had just a fantastic conversation, lots of interesting things. So our interview went quite long, but I think it's worth it. There's a lot of really
definitely,
great stuff. And our guest is Paul Levinson, who is a science fiction author as well as a media professor at Fordham University, and he's also a musician, and he and I had a lot in common, and Patrick as well, I mean, you know, because he writes a lot about television and media. So Patrick and I had a great conversation with him, so why don't we just get right to it, and here you go. Yeah, here's our interview with Paul Levinson.
We'll BS at the end.
Yeah. And on the line with us tonight, we have... he's most known for, or I first knew about our guest through his science fiction novels. He has quite a few out at this point, but he also is an expert on media and specifically new media. He is also a musician and a songwriter and, you know, kind of in the early part of his career really did a lot with that. And our guest tonight is Paul Levinson.
Well, I'm delighted to be here, and I do wear many hats because I don't have that much hair, so I need to... Actually, I don't really wear hats at all. I have one hat that I used to wear like on really bitterly cold winter days. Or so. In the Bronx, we called them beanies. In other parts of the country, they're called, I don't know, skull caps or whatever. But my wife hated that hat, so
she
badgered me into not wearing it anymore.
Yep. So. Well, to paraphrase Doctor Who, hats are cool.
Yeah, cool.
So, Paul, I'm glad you brought up the fact that you're in the Bronx because I know you are a professor at Fordham, and you know, reading through your Wikipedia page specifically, it's very interesting because you've done so many things in your career, and like I said, I'd first found out about you through your science fiction novels. You know, I got in touch with you through a mutual friend, Larry Ketcherson, who does some work with SF Signal.
That guy?
Yep, that dude. And he had, you know, said like, you know, you guys both are musicians and you're both into science fiction. You guys should, I bet you guys would have a lot in common. So it seems like you did a lot of your music stuff earlier in your career. So I would be curious. I'm sure it's a really long story, but I'd like to hear about how you sort of got involved in music and doing some songwriting. And then I know you at one point got into radio and how that eventually sort of leads you into becoming a college professor and an author. So maybe you could start with the music and how you got into music and then how you got into radio.
Sure. Well, here's an important thing to know about me. For some reason, maybe because I'm egotistical, but it just seems natural to me. Whenever I really love something, you know, some kind of aspect of our popular culture, whether it's music or science fiction, after a pretty short period of time, I not only love it as a listener or a reader, but I also begin thinking about how I can do it myself. And so when I was a kid, a very little kid, I mean, you're talking about, you know, well, not tiny, but say, you know, maybe 9 or 10 years old. This was, you know, the late 50s, and Alan Freed was on the radio on WINS. Murray the K was starting out. And I used to listen to rock and roll, and I love groups like the Diamonds. You know, in my, you know, view, some of the best records ever made were made by those old doo-wop groups, the Del Vikings, Come Go With Me.
You're not alone. There's a lot of people who think that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the harmony was great. I mean, the lyrics weren't, you know, all that much, but there was just a real vitality to the music. So let's go back to 1957 into 1958. I'm in the fifth grade, sixth grade, And that's when I formed my first rock group or singing group. And it was named Little Levy and the Emeralds. Not a very creative. I have no idea, you know, why we chose emeralds. Well, actually, I do. It was sort of like the diamonds. And even though no one in the group was Irish, you know, we were in the Bronx, so there was sort of like an Irish flavor to it. And in addition to that, in those days, green was my second favorite color. I'm not sure if it is anymore. I still like it. So I don't know, for a combination of those reasons, Little Levy, I wasn't that little, but Levinson was my last name. And what we would do, me and three or four other guys, it was very rudimentary harmony. And it was basically singing what the Diamonds were singing, what the Del Vikings were singing, a little of what Buddy Holly was singing. And let me just say here, not to go off on too much of a tangent, someone that I recently got in touch with, literally just this past summer, we'd been out of touch for probably about 50 years, was a guy by the name of Joel Iskowitz, who was a member of that early group. And he actually went on to become a world-class artist and designer. He has done some of the things that you see now on the back of U.S. quarters, and he's done, you know, stamps all over the world. So there was a lot of talent back there in the Bronx in PS 96. And, you know, as a few years passed by, you know, I was in one group and another. And I guess it was, you know, now we're moving into 1962, 1963. I've been singing on and off over the years in various groups. And I was working in a place called Crumbs. It was an ice cream parlor on the Grand Concourse in the Bronx. And that was a trip in itself. But there was a guy working there by the name of Ira who had a friend called Stu. And pretty soon the three of us started not only talking about music but singing. And out of that came a couple of groups, but eventually something called the New Outlook, which by the mid-1960s we were writing our own songs. I gravitated towards writing lyrics, but I did some music. We sounded something, you know, maybe like the Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, very early Love and Spoonful, the Beatles, their first couple of albums, although we were primarily an acoustic group. And just to jump way, way ahead, and I could talk about this for hours, today I put out on TuneCore, and it takes, you know, a day or two to show up on iTunes or even a little longer, an album called Spun Dreams, which consists completely of demos that I did with the New Outlook, with Stu and Ira, and a couple of songs that I did on my own. Some of these were literally recorded in Stu's living room, say 1965-66. And some were actually in the studio. Various people, like Ellie Greenwich, discovered us at some point in Central Park and brought us into the studio. So this represented a whole part of my life from the mid to the late 60s.
Did you ever record in the bathroom just for the acoustics?
Not in the bathroom, but we all went to City College. This is the City College of New York. And it was a really great school, especially if you didn't attend many classes. We didn't, because we spent a lot of time singing in what are called the alcoves, which were like sort of entrance halls to the cafeterias. And, you know, you talk about acoustics, forget about bathrooms and showers. These alcoves were unbelievable. I mean, you know, we sounded like, you know, when I did falsetto, it could have been Brian Wilson. It was so good. And so, you know, and actually, we're not that much of a live performance group. We were a little crazy. We once had a gig out in Queens, and we were hired to sing folk rock songs, you know, Dylan, stuff like that, which we did. But we had our own arrangement to the Four Tops, I'll Be There. You know, I'll be there. And it was a great arrangement, but the people in the audience were there to hear folk and folk rock, so they practically booed us off the stage. But this was something which would become a sort of hallmark of my career, whether it was music or science fiction. I always do things that are somewhat contrary to the grain, and I enjoy that. So that's sort of the answer to the question of how I got involved in music in the first place. I stayed in music through the early 70s. Eventually, the New Outlook broke up. I got together with a couple of other guys, Ed Fox. In fact, I was just talking to one of them, Donnie Frankel. He's now in California. We recorded an album called Twice Upon a Rhyme. And we had some interest in it from record companies, but another aspect, even now, but especially back then, is I'm very impatient when it comes to the point of get a publisher or a record company to take my work. I mean, I know it's great,
Why don't they?
That's right. I want to get it out to my audience. I once actually put together a collection of essays on a British philosopher, Karl Popper. And one of the people who contributed to that book, his name is Joseph Agassi, had a whole essay in that book about the sort of dilemma that every creative person has, which is what you want to do is communicate to your audience, right? If you write a song, you want the people out there to hear the song. If you write a story, you want readers to be able to read it. But up until very recently, the only way you could do that is you had to go through some kind of middleman, some kind of broker who would, in effect, ordain your work and say, okay, this is good enough to go out there. And that bothered me back then. It bothered me even now. And so we formed our own record company, Ed Fox and I, called Happy Sad Records. We put the album out. You know, I always joke that we sold a negative number of copies. That's obviously physically not possible, but it certainly felt that way. And then I pretty much forgot about the music until about 10 years ago, and then increasingly in the last couple of years, it's been rediscovered. But music has been a daily part of my life since ever I can remember. And, for me to just drive to work, Fordham University, where I teach, it's about 20 minutes from where I live, I rarely listen to news. I'm always listening to some kind of music station, and I'm always putting in some harmony parts. And since if I'm driving myself, there's nobody else in the car to tell me how off key it is. I have a good time. So
now, Paul, you were saying how you obviously started when you were quite young and kind of kept up with music through the 70s, through the early 70s at least. Now, at the same time, well, I don't know, is this going on at the same time when you're sort of earning all of your degrees? Because you do have a couple of advanced degrees, and did you kind of get back into academia after your music, or were you sort of doing the two concurrently? How did that kind of work?
Well, that's a good question about whether you can do things concurrently. I wasn't really joking when I said that I didn't attend that many classes at City College. In fact, I never finished City College. I got there when I was 16 because I was pretty young, and I did well. I got A's and B's for like the first year or two, but by the time I was 18. 19, it seemed clear to me that I could do much more good and damage in the world, basically singing and writing, than sitting in what to me were boring classes. Although I have to say that years later, when I wrote The Plot to Save Socrates, one of my science fiction novels, I actually thank in the preface to that book Henry Maggett, who was my philosophy professor. But that was when I was a freshman at City College. I was still enjoying the classes. Anyway, what happened is the more involved I got in music, the less involved I was in school. So I never did get my BA at City College. And I didn't go back to school, and this is significant, until 1974, when I had given up on the music. And although, as it turned out, not permanently. By 1974, though, I had already had published in the Village Voice three articles about music. One was a defense of Paul McCartney against... there was an article that Robert Christgau, one of the most sour critics, in human history, that this guy, he's still alive, and I don't care if he hears this, he doesn't like anybody. He had nothing good to say about anyone. I mean, he talked about dyspeptic. This guy, he coined the word, about Phil Oakes, your listeners may be interested in this. There's a new documentary about Phil Oakes that Tina, my wife, and I are going to see tomorrow night. A really incredibly talented and gifted songwriter with a beautiful voice. He didn't play guitar the greatest, but Robert Christgau, in his review of one of Phil Oakes' concerts, spent a long time talking about the ham-handed way Oakes plays his guitar. He wasn't a guitar player. He was just strumming the guitar. He has some kind of line. It sounds like sort of like a wounded duck strumming or something like that. So my first article that was published in the Village Voice in 1971 attacked Christgau for actually his negative review, not of Phil Oakes, but of Paul McCartney. And the editors of The Voice liked it enough. I sent it in as a letter, and they published it as an article. So that convinced me that, hey, I could make some money doing this writing thing. But after doing that for a little bit and sort of easing out of music, I went back to school in 1974, this time to NYU in the Village. I figured I'd be a little hipper than going to City College. And so what I pretty much did from 1974 to 1979 is complete my bachelor's degree, then go up the street to the New School for Social Research, get my MA in Media Studies, and then go back down the street to New York University and get my PhD in Media Theory. But what's interesting, as far as this idea, can you do things concurrently? By then, by the time I was working on my PhD, I was already writing my first science fiction novel. And I had this idea in my head that I could do both things at the same time. If not exactly at the same time, you know, I'd write a chapter of my dissertation, write a chapter of my novel, write a chapter of my dissertation. Well, that plan worked for about a month, and at that point I discovered I was always wanting to write another chapter of my novel than the dissertation, which makes sense because if you think about, hey, you make stuff up in a novel, the dissertation. So I realized, look, if I really want to get this PhD, if I want to get this dissertation finished, I, you know, better put the novel aside. So I did complete the dissertation, and what then happened is I went into teaching, went into writing scholarly stuff, nonfiction books. That was in 1979, and it wasn't really until 1990 that I began writing science fiction again. By the way, the good news about that novel, it was originally called, originally I called it Cross the Cartesian Rainbow, which is actually a good title for an album, John Ruthick. But it wasn't a good title for, it was a time travel novel. So I then called it Difference in Time, D-I-F-F-E-R-E-N-T-S, Difference in Time, like different people in time. But I later turned that into three novellas that were published in Analog Magazine in the 1990s. And one of them, the first one, Loose Ends, was nominated for a Hugo and a Nebula Award. So the novel did at least have some happy ultimate results.
That's great. Now, we actually, it's funny that you mentioned doing both of them at the same time. A pretty good friend of ours and of the show's is an author. His name is Blake Charlton. And he's a younger author, and he's doing... he's got a fantasy.
He's crazy.
Yeah, he's sort of the same thing that you're doing. He's a med student, and he's a published fantasy author through Tor, and he's kind of doing both at the same time. Like he's in the middle of writing a trilogy, and he's in the middle of his I guess he's doing a residency right now. So it's a similar kind of thing. He's got to kind of go bounce back and forth between the two. Like he'll have to spend like a semester really focusing on his work at school and going back to the novels.
But if you follow his Twitter feed, you know, he'll put a tweet out that says, "Hey, I successfully diagnosed a burst eardrum." And then, you know, like an hour later, "I'm working on a chapter and blah, 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 blah."
Well, actually, I love that. And what he's doing is actually much more dangerous than what I did, which I think is good. It's good to be dangerous because, let's face it, you know, when I got frustrated, you know, doing my, you know, PhD, I could just sort of like put it aside and maybe at the most crumple, you know, a piece of typewritten paper. But if this guy gets upset doing some kind of surgery, I mean, he can lop a person's ear off. Oh my God! I'm not sure if I'm gonna do that chapter. Oh my God! So ear off. But you know, I think it's a great idea. Well, listen, what's his name? You know, the guy who did the Andromeda Strain. He died not that long ago. Michael Crichton.
Crichton. Yeah.
Was an MD and a very talented science fiction writer.
Of course. Now, I'd like to talk a little bit about your involvement in radio.
Before you do that, John, I just have to throw this out there for Paul. On SF Signal, we were talking about different genres and different books and stuff. And I mentioned Michael Crichton, and two of the more well-read folks on the podcast, on the panel, were kind of like, that's not really science fiction.
Well, good. I'm glad you threw that out there for me, because I hope these people who said that aren't friends of mine or fans of mine. But I think that's a really idiotic statement. And usually I find that the least or the less that people know about science fiction, the more eager they are to define things out of the genre. The fact of the matter is, you know, Michael Crichton's classic science fiction. He and you know, in the tradition of Wells and Verne, and you know, what is science fiction? Ultimately, it's taking a scientifically plausible idea. Although in the case of time travel, it may not be even plausible, but it's sort of, you know, you can sort of put it in you know, a framework that seems like it's plausible, and writing a story around it. And Crichton was a master of that. I think the reason why some people say he's not science fiction is they're jealous of his success.
Success, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You know, if God forbid you write a book and it gets turned into a movie, no, that's not science fiction. Ironically, people and institutions that don't like science fiction are complicit in the same kind of thing. For example, the wonderful story Flowers for Algernon, which I think it may be like one of the best science fiction stories or stories period ever written, by Keyes, Daniel Keyes. That story, I saw this about 10 years ago, was more than any other story required reading of high school students. But what was interesting about this little survey that I saw, the teachers who assigned the stories didn't assign it as a science fiction story. They assigned it as like a very powerful story about human beings. But of course it's science fiction. If you could operate on a mouse and make it into a genius, you know, that's obviously a science fiction story.
Yep.
But so there seems to be in our society a view in some quarters that if it's really successful and becomes mainstream, that makes it ipso facto not science fiction, but that makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
So, I
wanted to ask about your involvement in radio, because I know that you mentioned Murray the K, and you also I saw Wolfman Jack come up at some points with you online. So what's your involvement in radio and with Wolfman Jack?
Well, bear in mind what I said before about always wanting to do that which I love in popular culture. And, you know, what I said about listening to radio starting in the mid-1950s, it was not only the music that I loved, it was the disc jockey. It was DJing in that old sense of the word. Here in the New York area, you're probably familiar with him, John, mm-hmm. you know, someone like what Bob Shannon does mm-hmm. on CBS FM. So the first article that I wrote for the Village Voice, as I mentioned, was attacking Robert Christgau and his lame attack on Paul McCartney. The second article that I wrote had to do with Murray the K, who was on the radio in the late 50s. He was huge in the early and mid-60s, first on WINS as a sort of an AM top 40 fast-talking disc jockey. And then he was one of the pioneers, in fact, the pioneer on the East Coast, a progressive FM radio on WOR-FM. But he left at some point. I'm not exactly sure even now to this day why he left. He was a sort of like, you know, temperamental guy. Probably someone, you know, annoyed him, you know, didn't give him the deal he wanted. He spent some time in Washington, D.C. I think was on a station in Montreal. Anyway, in the summer of 1972, one fine day, my then girlfriend Tina, who later became my wife, we're listening to the radio, and we hear it's the July 4th weekend that Murray the K is going to be on the radio. And at first, you know, we thought, hey, maybe they're playing a recording of something that he did earlier. But in fact, WNBC Radio here in New York hired Murray to come back for that July 4th weekend. And it was spectacular, you know, hearing Murray on the radio. So I wrote a piece for the Village Voice, because at this point I figured I could get it published as a piece since I was, you know, paid for the first one. And it was basically an article about how good it was for Murray K to be back in New York. Now, one thing which any writer knows if you write for the press is you have no control over the titles of your articles. If you write fiction, you do have some control. I mean, you know, an editor is not likely in a science fiction magazine to change the title of your story, but without asking you at least. But if you're writing for newspapers, even weekly newspapers like the Village Voice, they just slap on any title that they like, and it's too bad. So this was a very positive article that I wrote about Murray, but I had one line in the article, and I said, you know, but Murray the K has to be careful. If he wants to be successful, you know, here in New York again, he has to make sure that nostalgia doesn't become a noose around his neck, because that's what he's known for. So wouldn't you know it, The Voice publishes my article. They send me a check for $75. I'm thrilled about that. But the title of the article, which I discover when I, you know, pick up my copy of The Voice, is Murray the K in Nostalgia's Noose. I mean, the typeface, it almost looked like someone was hanging in that. So I'm saying, great, thank you very much. But this is the answer to how I wound up getting into radio. About 2 days later, I get a call. I was working in those days at New York University, in a place called the Berg Institute. I don't know how Murray tracked me down, but I get a call. I say hello, and I hear a very familiar voice. And he says, you know, is this Paul Levinson? I said, yeah, it is. And I knew who it was, but he said, well, this is Murray the K. I said, oh, amazing. You know, how you doing? So I just want to thank you, man, for that article. You know, you had a lot of good ideas in it. I said, well, hey, you know, I don't know what the hell I said, actually. But he said, you know, why don't you come down to the studio? We can talk and over a cup of coffee. So I did. And what came out of that is he offered me a job as a producer of his show. And what that was all about was, Murray really was a genius when it came to radio, even back in the 60s. And for him, the whole progressive aspect of radio was you did more than just play songs and introduce them. You put together segues of songs, thematically linked songs. And so that's what he was interested in doing. And he asked me to help him do that. And so, for example, I put together for Murray what I thought of as a Law and Order set. You know, I fought the law and the law won. And then followed by Indiana wants me. Lord, I can't get back there. That's a great song, by the way. It ends with like police siren and some voice saying, you are surrounded. Give yourself up. Anyway, about 10 songs where, you know, people were involved in some kind of criminal activity and there were cops closing in on them. And that's the kind of thing that I did for Murray. And that actually segued into Wolfman Jack, because, again, Murray, with his temperamental personality, I guess he stayed at NBC a little over a year. One of the things I did do is I wrote a song called Murray the K's Back in Town, which you can hear on Spun Dreams. I included it on the album. I went into the studio and just, laid down a couple of tracks. I got Pete Rosenthal, who's a great guitar player. He did work on Twice Upon a Rhyme. To go in and play every instrument, and you know me, you know, doing the lead and the harmony. So I gave that to Murray, and he loved that, and he played it on the show. I assume that's not what it was that upset him, but he began getting, you know, just not enjoying what he was doing at NBC. I guess they were telling him, you know, hey, you know, you just can't put together strings of like 35 related songs. You know, you got to do shorter, you know, units for your segues and themes. But it was really Murray's personality. He just really wasn't, and I don't blame him. You know, he was a very creative guy, and he liked doing what he was doing, and he didn't want to, you know, hear program directors tell him what to do. So so he left, and they brought in Wolfman Jack. NBC did as Murray's replacement, and for maybe about a month, both of them were working together. And one day, Wolfman Jack came into the studio, and Murray and I were talking. And Murray said, do you know Wolfman? I said, no, I don't. And Murray says, this is, you know, Paul Levinson, you know, he helps me. And Wolfman says, oh, great to meet you, man. You know, this is a very exciting field we're in. And, you know, the old Wolfman can always use a little help. And so when Murray left, Wolfman called me and said, hey, you know, would you be interested in doing
work? You have to do the voice.
Yeah. I said, oh, hey, man, you know, you're... That's such a good job for Murray. I thought you could help the old Wolfman out. You know, you get what I'm saying? So I said, well, absolutely. But the difference between Murray and the Wolfman is Murray didn't pay me much at all. I mean, I can't remember he ever went, well, give me some, you know, check or maybe take me out to dinner. Wolfman Jack said he was going to pay me. He never paid me a cent. And one day I came in and asked him, I said, by the way, I was like, you know, I was pretty young in those days, and I had another job. I was doing it mainly, you know, for the fun. And he said, well, no, don't worry, the old Wolfman, I'll pay you, you know, before the month is out. It turned out to be a very long month. And then the Wolfman eventually left. But it was also spectacular working with him. And you know, whereas Murray was like a very conceptual guy. Murray was temperamental, but very high abstraction, putting together his shows. The Wolfman was just what you'd expect. He was, just emotional, but in the best possible way. And, just even being in the studio with him and, hearing his laugh and hearing his cackle. And so he left. And then the last article I wrote for the Village Voice was called Wolfman Hits the Road, Jack. And it was a piece, that I wrote after Wolfman left. So with Murray, I wrote the piece before I started working for him. With Wolfman, I wrote the piece after he left. But in the interest of saving his public image, I didn't say that he never paid me. So.
Until now.
Until now. So, Wolfman, I hope you forgive me, but, hey, Wolfman, I'm sure you can understand. Can you get what I'm saying, baby?
Yeah. Well, and Paul, I feel like we could talk about this stuff all night, but one of the last things I wanted to kind of bring up with you, and kind of brings the question with, talking about your experience in radio and I think nowadays radio would be considered kind of old media. And, I know this is a lot of what you do as a professor, as a media professor. And I know you have, a pretty recent book called New Media. And I'd like to hear, maybe some of your thoughts about what new media is and what, what the book is about. Because I think we're going through a very, and have been for the past, 5 years or maybe even more than that. With what new media is and what it does for everybody, but particularly for creative people and artists.
Well, and I have a follow-up question after you answer that. But just one of the things that he just was saying, how did he get found? How did Murray the K find him? I was just sitting here thinking to myself, how did we find people before the internet?
Yeah, but that's a very good question, because that's why Murray the K found me, because I was able to use the old, not even new media, but the old media system of newspaper publishing. I was able to succeed in that because I got one of the gatekeepers. In fact, I remember her name, Diane Fisher. I never met her in person. She was the editor at the Village Voice who published the piece that I wrote. I sent it in as a letter to the editor attacking Christgau, and Diane Fisher published it as something called Your Voice or whatever it was called. And so the Village Voice had a way of, in effect, taking someone who's just writing a letter and promoting that person into a writer. And in a way, that was a very, very early example of new media. I wasn't stuttering when I came up with the term new media. I was trying to show how old-fashioned traditional new media are. And here's what I meant. And actually, that's changed since the time my book was published in the fall of 2009, and certainly since the time I was writing it. If you look at Amazon and iTunes, circa 2007, is a good example. Let's look at Amazon. The only way anybody could get a book onto Amazon was to have a publisher print up the book. I mean, you could print up your own book and so on, but that was not considered very classy. So, you basically needed someone else, once again, to select your work and put it on Amazon. So even though Amazon was a new medium, and it existed online, and exists online, it operated in a very old-fashioned, what media theorists call top-down way, meaning people at the top decide what comes up from the bottom. And if you look at iTunes, the same thing applied. How did an artist, not on a label, get on iTunes in 2007? The answer is they did not. And you had to be, submitted by some kind of record label. So it seemed to me, as I was thinking about this in 2007 and 2008, that you had online many systems which used old media gatekeeping ways of selecting their content. In addition to that, and this is true still for both Amazon and iTunes, the consumer had to pay for the content. So you had to buy the book on Amazon, you had to buy the song on iTunes. What began to change, though, is with the advent of blogging Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, all of these media, YouTube, suddenly anybody can put their work online. So anybody can create a blog. It doesn't cost anything to do it, nor does it cost anything for people to read it. If you have a video, you can put it up on YouTube. So for the first time, the consumer is able to effortlessly or just about effortlessly transform herself or himself into a producer. Now, I said Amazon iTunes actually have gone a little way. Maybe Jeff Bezos and whoever it is Steve Jobs at iTunes, maybe they read New Media and they said, hey, we got to begin changing our system. Because now in 2011 with Kindle books, almost anyone can get their work up there on Amazon. And it's now extremely easy to get your work on iTunes. I mean, it costs a little bit of money, you know, if you use TuneCore or Reverb Nation or CD Baby, but nonetheless, you don't have to be signed to a label anymore to get your work out there. So I think this is one of the most profoundly revolutionizing developments in human history, because as far as I know, and I've studied this for decades, from the very beginning, we have been operating in a situation where the creative person had to get the approval of some kind of business person to get the creative person's work out there. There was just no way. I mean, I say from the very beginning, presumably Homer didn't need anybody's permission. He could wander around and, recite, the Iliad.
That depends. Was Homer married?
Good point. Yeah. It's a very astute point. And I was going to say, Moses didn't need anybody's permission, but depending upon how literally you take the Old Testament, okay, Moses needed the deity's permission. So, but still, he didn't need some businessman's permission. But pretty quickly, and certainly when we get into post-Renaissance and the rise of the printing press, suddenly you have an entity, the publisher, the editor, that has life and death power over everything that's written, whether that gets out to the general public. And that's pretty much the way it's been. And the invention of radio and then television and actually before radio, motion pictures. None of those media changed that top-down gatekeeping way of doing business. And even the internet didn't really change it until the advent of what I see as new media. And I think we're at the beginning of what may well be the most creative time in human history, precisely because for the first time in human history, anyone can get their work out to millions of people. And I think that's a very promising and exciting place to be.
And it scares the hell out of old media.
Absolutely it does. And they're panting and struggling to keep up. But, you can't count old media out.
There's always 3D.
Well, that's right. But, I mean, even I'm a frequent critic of the New York Times, and I point out, they say all the news that's fit to print, hardly. They're really all the news that we, the New York Times, deems fit to print. Yep. So, it's not all the news at all. They make decisions. But nonetheless, I won't lie to you. I was thrilled when my first novel, The Silk Code, got a good review in the New York Times. That was great. Just as I was thrilled when The Plot to Save Socrates got a good review in Entertainment Weekly. So, these are old media par excellence. And it doesn't matter if they have like an online component. They're old because they're controlled by editors. But, we in new media still value their approval, which makes sense because, John knows this, when you create something, you need to use every single aspect of promotion at your disposal to, again, get it out to your audience. And although you can do a lot yourself, the old media, the new media, as well as new media, each can play an important role.
Absolutely. And one other thing I wanted to throw in there is, you had said, Paul, that, it is a very profound time because, there's very little barrier. You don't have to go through a gatekeeper. And I think there, certainly in music, and I think in other creative aspects too, there were also gatekeepers in even creating your work. So if you were going to record yourself, I know I'm in my mid-30s now, and when I started writing and recording music when I was in high school and college, you really could, there was home studio equipment, but it was pretty minimal and basic. And if you
Tascam.
Were, yeah, I had like a Tascam 4-track like everybody
yep.
did.
And I had one.
You could get it to sound okay, but it wasn't really professional level quality. So I remember being in bands all through college and, we'd go and make a demo. And, you'd have to like work in the supermarket or whatever you had to do to scrape together like $1,000 to go and record a 3-song demo that you were never happy with anyway. And what these demos were for, I have no idea. None of them ever really helped me out. But, nowadays you could take that same $1,000 and go and buy a laptop. You can go get a MacBook and have GarageBand already in on it and get yourself a decent microphone. And you have a recording studio that is, it's almost hard to even imagine if you think back to even 10 years ago what you can do now for a minimal financial investment. You can really do amazing things. And I think between sort of that kind of democratization of the tools to create and then having these tools to get it out there, I think it is a very creative time. And I know a lot of people will bemoan that will say that, oh, it's just going to be a bunch of amateurs and it's going to be a lot of crap. And my feeling on that is, well, so what? Like, don't listen to the stuff you don't like or don't read the stuff you don't like. The good stuff will find its way. And stuff that maybe would just have a smaller audience will also find its way. But I think it's only a good thing to have these avenues open for anybody that wants to pursue them.
Oh, well, I agree completely. And the key, and actually this speaks to the value of spending the $1,000 15 or 20 years ago. And this gets back again to what I was saying about Spun Dreams. When I recorded those demos, when I, Stu Nitikman and Ira Margolis with the New Outlook recorded, and people will be able to hear this song on Spun Dreams, just to pick a particular song, 2-1. 2-1 = nothing at all when you take away one you love. We recorded that song in 1966, but because we took the step of recording it, it existed and continued to exist until this afternoon when I released that song as part of the Spun Dreams album and, now to be out there to the world. It was that decision on that day, whenever it was in 1966, just the act of recording that song that made all the difference. And so what I always tell people, and this pertains to songwriters, it pertains to fiction writers, if you have something in your head, you need to do more than think about it. You need to do more than say it. You need to either write it or record it, get it into some kind of form so it can live independent of whatever else you're doing. And that means that someday, in a way that you might not at all expect it at the time, it can get out to the world and have a whole new life. And John, you're completely right. What new media do is they make it much easier now, much less expensive to do that. And by the way, I think we should tell people John and I are writing some science fiction songs, and I'm writing the lyrics, John's writing the music, and I think they're great. And we're going to be recording them, and the world will be able to hear them at some point. And that's exactly an expression of what John was talking about. If we'd been doing this 20 years ago, we'd have to make a decision, is it worth spending the money to go into the studio? Or if we did record it, what would it sound like? Now we can rest assured that it's going to sound, pretty good, and it's not going to cost us, much money. So it makes it that much easier to take that step, to go from the ephemerality of thought and unrecorded speech into the potential eternity and permanency of something being recorded or written and being out there.
Well, yeah, and you know, I'm obviously excited about what Paul and I are putting together, and it just, you know, it's all a result of all of this new media, because like I said, Larry Ketresid, who we've done the SF Signal podcast with, you know, I wouldn't have known Larry. I think Larry lives in – where does Larry live?
He'll be furious that you don't know. Larry lives in – actually, I can't remember, though. Larry lives in Houston, although –
That's right. That's right, yeah. He had lunch with DiNardo.
That's right. What I thought.
Yeah. Houston, I think so.
Yeah. Well, that's what I mean. It's like I would have never known Larry before. I have an association with him through doing the SF Signal podcast, and he sort of thought about us together. And I'd certainly been familiar with Paul and knew that he did music and knew that, hey, this would be a good person to know. And so Larry sort of sets us up, and, you know, I threw out the idea to Paul, like, hey, we should try to write something together. Paul emailed me lyrics like that day, I think, or the next day. And then I emailed him back a little music that I put together. So this kind of just between the communication channels and everything else, it really facilitates creation. And it is a very exciting time to be in, that that there is an ease in terms of, you know, just doing it and then putting it out there. And we could just put it out on our own, and the people that like what we do can check it out and buy it, and whatever, you know, what happens, happens. But
now, here's a telling moment for you, though. You know, talking earlier about how, you know, before the internet, how did you find somebody? I had a 4-track, you had a 4-track. We're kind of poo-pooing the 4-track now because we're talking about, you know, our MacBooks and GarageBand, all this kind of cool stuff we have. And in the back of my head, I'm thinking, but the Beatles thought like a 4-track recorder was, you know, like landing on Mars. It was like the coolest thing they had ever seen.
Yeah. Well, it is. I mean, and you know, I'm sure Paul is familiar with Les Paul's work, and, you know, Les Paul, who had a lot to, well, who essentially invented multi-track recording, and it is probably the single biggest, you know, influence on modern music. And so it is. So I certainly do not poop with a 4-track. That was the greatest day of my life when I was 17 years old and I went to Sam Ash and I spent like $500 on that 4-track. And the thing is, it's funny because, you know, Paul is saying that, you know, those songs existed, and I wrote, I don't know, must have been 100 songs on that 4-track. But one of the problems with 4-tracks was that you had to you couldn't just take that cassette tape and then dump it into your normal cassette player.
No.
What would happen? It would play at half speed, I believe. You had to mix it down. And I must have had 40 or 50 songs that I never mixed down that just don't exist anymore because I never took that stuff, which is a drag. But anyway.
That's like my box of stories that I wrote on a typewriter.
Yeah.
Well, but as long as you have them, you can still, you know, put them on a computer.
It's worse than the music, though, because when you go back through those and you read those, you're going, oh my God, I sucked so bad.
I always tell people, it's true, don't be too severe a critic on yourself. There's a thing that I think most human beings have, and especially writers, it's like a little, you know, messed up part of our personalities, and, you know, if you want to be Freudian about it, it's because of one of our parents, but it tends to be super critical about everything that we create, and it's hard to be successful if you pay much attention to that. And I remember, you know, everybody starts off saying, oh my God, I wrote this, oh wow, I can't believe it, and you just have to sort of ignore that, because chances are, if you wrote it, it can't be all that bad. And, you know, even if it is, let somebody else say that it's bad. You shouldn't be the one, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't edit or, you know, shouldn't have a critical eye towards your own work. But I think a lot of talent gets bottled up because the creator is too critical of his or her own work. By the way, I want to say about Les Paul, you know, having studied the media and, you know, putting on my hat as a media historian, it's, you know, there are certain things in the history of media that are true miracles, you know, and the idea of recording to your own voice, you know, da 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 da, and then you play that back and you go da 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 da, and it's basically you doing both parts. I mean, think about that. That, you know, just wasn't possible before Les Paul came up with that. And because how can any person, I mean, the closest we got to it, that's why the Andrews sisters, you know, the McGuire sisters, you know, brothers and sisters had similar voices, so they could do pretty good harmony. But, you know, in retrospect, that was a true miracle. I guess, you know, maybe late 1940s when he first figured it out. And it did change, you know, music completely.
Yeah, there's a great Les Paul documentary that I think it was PBS that put together. And then I know it was up on Netflix for a while. You can stream it through Netflix. But if you search for Les Paul on Netflix, you'll find this really great documentary on him. And even if you go to YouTube and you put Les Paul and multi-track recording, you'll get this great clip from a TV show. It must have been from the 40s, I guess. I must have been a popular show at the time. And it's Les Paul and Mary Ford, who was his wife at the time and his partner, and of them sort of live multi-tracking. I don't know if they were actually live multi-tracking or if they'd had, you know, the other parts planned, but they sort of take it through and you see Les Paul sort of creating like three or four layers of guitars, and then Mary Ford has three or four layers of her voice. And it's so great. And I'm as I've said before, I'm a music teacher in an elementary school, and I did a whole lesson on Les Paul for my fifth graders one day, and I showed them this thing, and it's like, it really is amazing to see that. And this was going on in the 40s, and that is absolutely worth, you know, it's a little 5-minute clip on YouTube. So put Les Paul in multi-track recording, and I think you'll find this awesome clip from the 40s. But we should probably wrap up because we're going real long. We've been trying to keep our show shorter. But so, Paul, I'd love to talk more and more. But why don't you, to finish up, why don't you throw out your various websites and social media that people can follow you on, and anything else that you want people to know about?
All right. Well, so here's some of the things to look forward to or run away from that I've created. Sometime in the next couple of months, Analog Magazine, which was the first – actually, the second. I was first published in Astounding magazine, but Analog was the first magazine. I'm sorry, I was first published in Amazing Stories, but Analog, which used to be called Astounding, was the first magazine to, on a regular basis, publish my short fiction. And when I started writing novels, I pretty much stopped writing short fiction because, you know, novels take up a lot of your time. But I decided to get back into writing short fiction. So I have a story called Eons, Eons, and Eons. And, you know, you can sort of figure it out. I-A-N is the character's name. And it has to do with I-O-N-S and E-O-N-S. And it's basically a time travel story. That's going to be published, a novelette in Analog in the next couple of months. I even have a sequel to it called Ian, Isaac, and John, and that actually is both a time travel and a music story. So that should be also published in Analog in the next 6 or 7 months. So that's, you know, something I'm happy about regarding my science fiction. As far as my music is concerned, Twice Upon a Rhyme was just reissued a couple of weeks ago on remastered vinyl by a British company, and they did an unbelievable job on it. They made the instruments sound more vibrant than I actually remember them sounding when I heard them live in the studio. That's how, you know, good the remastering is. And I mentioned my new album, Spun Dreams, and hey, you know, what I'm doing with John, I'm very excited about that. So I'm sure the world will be hearing something about that in terms of music also. As far as nonfiction is concerned, at some point there's going to be a new edition of New Media, but I'm also working on a book which I've been working on and off for about 5 or 6 years called The Flouting of the First Amendment. And that book is really a warning about how much our right to free speech and press has been trampled on by our own government and people who say they understand the Constitution, which is not to say I'm a Tea Party or anything like that, but I think I understand English. And when it says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech or the press. I don't get how the FCC can tell television and radio stations. So but maybe that's just me. But anyway, so that book will be out there soon. As far as where to find me, I'm Paul Lev. That's PaulLev on Twitter. My main blog, you can find it at infiniteregress.tv. It's the word infinite, followed by the word regress. That's one word, .tv. And that blog consists primarily of reviews of all the best television shows, which when I'm judging what's best, you'll find a lot of science fiction in there. In
fact, I just did a SmackDown, Deep Space Nine versus Babylon 5.
Ah, it sounds like fun.
SF Signal.
Yeah, all right, I'll take a look at it. And in fact, after we get up, I'm going to watch, I have it on DVR, The Return of V. So that's one of the shows I'm going to do there.
Yep. Yeah.
I have a lot of different podcasts. The best place to find, I have like three podcasts going. I'll give you a page where you can find all three of them. It's LevinsonNewsClips.com, and that's also one word. LevinsonNewsClips.com. And just do Paul Levinson and YouTube, and that'll get you to my YouTube channel, where you'll see me versus Bill O'Reilly, who, by the way, not on one of these television clips, but one of the times he interviewed me on radio, he did tell me to shut up. So I'm so honored about that. I wish I could have like a little recording of that could just like put. I'll see if I can get one, actually. Maybe I'll put it at the beginning of one of my podcasts. Anyhow, so
if it's out there, I can record it for you.
All right.
I can capture any audio.
Yeah, well, it is there somewhere. I think it's on. I mean, he had some kind of website. I'm not sure if it's still up there. We had like clips from his radio shows, but I'm not sure if it's still there. But hey, if you find it, by all means, it was an interview I did with him about 5 or 6 years ago on the radio. So that's that's pretty much it. What else other than the blog? I think I'm leaving something out. Well, you know, people can look for me on Facebook. I'm just Paul Levinson there. And although one of the problems with Facebook, you're only allowed 5,000 friends. So I'm now about like at 4,600 and change.
Yikes.
What they tell you is if you get up to 5,000, you should make a fan page. But, even I, with my forget about infinite regress, when you're talking about me, my infinite ego, I don't feel all that good saying, hey, I tell you what, forget about being my friend, become my fan on this page. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what I'm going to do there, but I also have a music page, Paul Levinson's Music, on Facebook as well. And if you go to Reverb Nation, reverbnation.com/Paul Levinson, you'll find a whole bunch of my music. By the way, anybody who wants to write to me, let me give you my email. It's levinson.paul@gmail.com. And I don't mind getting flooded with email. And I have actually a music list, which I just created. So if you'd like to get on the music list, and you'll get an automatic announcement of all the great, things that John and I are going to be doing and who knows what else, just let me know by email and I'll put your name on that list. So I could talk for another 5 hours, but
Well, Paul, thanks so much for coming on. We really appreciate it, and yeah, I'm sure people will be hearing more from you and more from some of the stuff that we're doing. So, thanks a lot, Paul.
My pleasure.
And we're back. Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Paul. As Paul said, he and I are working on some music together, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, that's cool. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, and once again, I want to thank Larry Ketcherson who got us together, who emailed the two of us. So I'm really grateful for that. And hopefully you'll see some music from us in a couple of months. We don't have any super plans, but we're writing really well together and coming up with some good stuff. So I don't know what's going to end up with that, but I'm sure it'll end up online at some point.
The only problem with the whole interview with Paul Levinson is when he was talking about how writers have this little voice inside telling them that that stuff that they do is terrible, and then that's just not right. Yeah, he's absolutely wrong, because we know for a fact that everything we write sucks.
I think everything I write is awesome. I don't know. Spot a lot of great things. We hope to have him on the show again.
What is your timetable on the music? I mean, do you guys have you discussed it that far?
What do you mean in terms of like getting it out into the world?
Yeah, I mean, are you? It's like, oh, we're going to get our first song out on the 15th of February.
Well, we haven't talked about how we want to put it out yet. We have some ideas, but we wrote one tune and we're kind of like halfway through writing a second one right now. So I'm not sure what we're going to do. If we're just going to sort of put them out as singles online, or maybe record four or five of them and put them out as a little EP or something.
Given his background, I'm thinking you guys should do 45s.
Yeah, pressing into vinyl. But so, I mean, I don't know. Within a couple of months, I imagine.
It could be a kitschy thing. It could catch on.
Yeah, but anyway, so I obviously have that going on with Paul, and you can just get my normal stuff at johnanilio.bandcamp.com, and you could follow me at twitter.com/johnanilio. Patrick, anything you got going on this week?
I'm just laughing. I'm amused.
Well, I'm just trying to keep it short.
I know. You know what? I want everybody to go check out. I got a bug up my butt, and I decided to start writing a new thing for SF Signal. Actually, I decided to start writing two new things for SF Signal, but you only get to hear about one right now, because the other one deals with Lisa Pates Spindler and I doing something. Cool. We're collaborating on something. That's later. The thing that's up right now on SF Signal is the TV genre Smackdown.
Oh.
And this first one is, you know, you always have the fans of genre shows, you know, that have a similar premise saying that this is better than that. You know, it's like the whole Star Wars, Star Trek rivalry. So the first one that I wrote about is Babylon 5 versus Deep Space Nine.
Cool. Is that up already right now?
It is up already, yeah. In fact, I've already gotten like 15 comments. So by the time this goes live, hopefully I'll have 50.
Cool.
But that's interesting. And I have a whole list of genre shows. You know, I've got things planned like The X-Files versus Supernatural, or Kolchak versus The X-Files. I had, what did I have? Alf versus Third Rock from the Sun.
Awesome.
Cool. So I have this whole list. I have this whole thing planned. So that's up. Tonight, as we're recording this, I have nothing for Grasping for the Wind. And I've already told John Ottinger, and I've got like, 9, 10, 11, 12. I got 4 hours to write a post for tomorrow.
Okay. Well, go for it. Well, I'll let you go then.
All right.
Well, all right. And you could follow Patrick at ATFMB.
Yes.
And ATFMB.com. And he's ATFMB on Twitter. And follow him with all that stuff.
There's a whole thing there.
Anyway, next
week. It's like a pattern.
Yeah, it is. It is like a pattern. We have some great interviews coming up. One's not – well, I guess they're all flicker. We have Jody Lanai coming up. We have Lavi Tzedera coming up. We have lots of cool folks coming up. So, stick around and come back next week. All right, everyone. Have a good week.
Bye.
I'm with you all the way. We're What's Happened, sweetheart.
Well, I got the Beatles with me.
Yeah, John.
Hello, WINF 1010.
That away, baby. And let's check out Ringo.
Hi, baby. This is WINS Winds on 1010. Ringo from the Beatles talking.
All right, we got Joy.
I can't do that.
Hello, everybody. WINS, there we go.
And we got Paul over here. Paul?
How do you do, everybody? WINS Winston Churchill.
Winston Churchill is right, I say.
Here's another drink.
Yeah.
How are they now, Vera? Are they kind of excited about their appearance on the TV show tonight?
Yeah, man, they're excited about it, but they're also taking it in stride.
Wake up, John. John, wake up.
John, wake up, John.
Okay.
Gotta go on, so.
Okay, Murray.
Right, okay, babe.
What's happening, baby? It's the gear.
It's the gear, baby. That's what's happening. The gear's happening. I think that gives you an idea, Paul, that how loose they are. They're loose like a goose.
Yeah,
they're hanging in there.
Yeah, they're swinging fellas.
They got some ice cubes in their pocket. They're staying cool, man.
Yeah.
You got something lined up there. How about love you do?
Love me do.
No, they love you do. They love I love me do.
Boy,
they love you do. What's the name of it?
Pardon?
What's the name of that song, mate?
Love me do, Wacker.
I see. this is the Wacker speaking here. The Wacker over here. And
Wacker the K.
Wacker the K. Let's hear the Beatles sing it, baby.
Okay, Mary, here we go.
Rolling Stones, pick your pick, playing lead mouth, you understand?